Hello, 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 and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. I trust you've had a stimulating and interesting and fascinating weekend. And a fascinating weekend, and that all is well, and that all has been jolly good, and that you are enjoying the beginnings of summer. So cheers, everybody. Cheers, Al 2020. Cheers, Adrian the R. Cheers, Paul. Cheers, Morgoth. Cheers, oh, he's gone again. I have had a haircut, Resident Poet, that's correct. Cheers, Resident Poet. Hurligan Gurligan, Capis, Salu, Saludo, Proof,
Lachayim, Scrubyanan.
Yaki Dar, Tervisexy, Slanger, and Hello, Avis Predis, and Slangervar. And welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We're, of course, online public house. It's on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York Prost, in which we discuss based stuff. What is going on? Internet homeless, based stuff, and things which are stuff in the news and psychology and literature and things which are expunged. Ho Charlie Sparkles from our woke joke universities. And I have a very special guest for you today, and that is Morgoth. So Morgoth, would you mind cheers Charlie Pepper, cheers Lord Quebec, would you mind introducing yourself?
I'm writer and sometimes video essayist, Morgoth's Review. I run a Substack and give some takes and do some ponderings on the current state that we're in on YouTube and Substack. And I'm on Twitter as well, but I don't really take that as a serious platform, to be honest.
Fair enough. All right, well, cheers, Morgoth. And Morgoth is from that part of England, by the sound of it, where I went to university. And I discovered up that way. Lipton, please try hard to stay in the chat, to stay in. Right, good. Hello, Lipton, are you all right?
No, I need a background. I don't have work. I need to get back my background.
Yeah, that's weird, because I thought you genuinely lived in that mansion.
No, I need to get my background.
In that New York condominium. By the way, Lipton, this is Morgoth. I don't know if you know Morgoth. So hello and cheers, Lipton. Okay, so yeah. What we're going to start off with then is the last week. I mean, we last met on Monday, of course. Tuesday was this protest. And one of the first things that I noticed about that protest is that the police didn't run away. In July, or whatever it was, May 2021, the police ran away, and the police also took the knee. They did that, and they ran away. Whereas this time, they hit people with riot shields, hit bystanders with riot shields. Hit bystanders with riot shields, from what I could work out, have made various arrests. So, and they certainly didn't take the knee. So that in itself is, as they were being shouted out to do, so that in itself is indicative of two tiers. And then, of course, we have the CEO of Iceland. That's Bjarne's, if anyone remembers Bjarne's, rather than the nation state. Commenting on their biased policing. Oh my goodness. Lipton, only try to come back in if you're really sure, because it's getting a little bit embarrassing. Morgoth, what were your thoughts on the last on the protest on Tuesday?
I don't like protests. I don't like these things. I don't really see what the point of it was. And if I'm honest, I didn't pay much attention. And I get criticised when I say that, but I just feel like if you look at it from the perspective of the regime, and like they were just begging to have an off-ramp from the immediate problem, which was the two-tier policing problem, the murder of Henry Novak, what are the racial kind of policies that the police have to operate under, and all of these kinds of things. And then all of a sudden, you get this like big rally where people are throwing wheelie bins around, and this becomes the focus. And I think it's a gift to the establishment, because you're giving them a kind of bull tool to go down and churn out news stories about, when I wanted to kind of pin them down and have them kept pinned down on what actually happened in there to begin with. So, and it's always the same. They tried it a little bit with Farage, where you get the initial problem. I did an article last week where, remember when it used to be the the Islamic terror attacks that we used to get more frequently, and you would have like thoughts and prayers, and it was like prayer for Paris or Berlin or wherever it was, and it was the regime trying to find like a comfortable narrative to get away with the process, get off the hook for the fact that they had allowed these people in the first place. And so when you get, they try to do that here as well, and they were stuck for the first day or so. And then all of a sudden you get Nigel Farage, he comes out and he says, you know, he makes a quite ballsy speech. And then, so they all pick up on that, and then you get these riots, and they all get, so they get off, they kind of get off the hook with it. I don't think they have entirely. I don't think it was all that successful, but this is why I tend not to like it. I want them to stay in the trap where they are, rather than be able to change it and say, oh, look at all these thugs on the streets throwing policemen around or whatever it was. So that's my general thought. I mean, I know people don't like it and they'll say, well, you've got to get out there and do something, you know, but I just prefer to have them in the checkmate position.
I'm not sure about them taking the knee. Like, it strikes me that saying I can't breathe, that's kind of mocking the regime ideology. And showing them up as the hypocrites that they are, and all that kind of thing. But I wonder if when it comes to taking the knee, that's a bit like you're just imitating the slogans in a way of your opponents, and therefore you're ceding to them some kind of authority.
It's parodic, isn't it? They're not doing it sincerely.
Are they doing the knee sincerely, or are they taking the
fist? No, it's parodic. They're just making the blatant visual point that they know the police won't respond. So I think that's quite a powerful visual image.
Yeah, there is that, to be honest. There is the you know, like I say, I don't want to be too hard on the protest, because what they did sort of nail was just the howling hypocrisy of the authorities and of the police and the politicians and all the rest of it. Because we all know that the BLM riots were burning cities down, pulling statues down, and all of that kind of thing. And the police just groveled on their bellies before them. So, yeah, they did actually showcase that. Like.
And, Morgoth, the other thing they showcased was, I don't know whether you saw the footage of the, I think he was an ex-army guy, but the guy who had a pinned ankle and didn't have full mobility.
Yeah.
He sat on a wall. And in the footage I've seen, the police are actually kicking him in the head by the time they got him on the ground. And people see that, and that makes a huge, you know, impact on that. You can talk about two-tier policing, but when you see the complete cowardice in front of other groups, then you see how they treat mostly white people. It is pretty obvious.
And it's strange because I think we would be aware of it if you're on social media, and if you see that there's a kind of meme version of the UK now. I mean, literally the word UK is itself now a meme, which is like this sort of deterritorialized non-place with run by feminists and kind of gay people, and everybody loves minorities and all the rest of it. But the actual police and the institutions, they're not aware of themselves as being that it's become this sort of international joke. And they play into the kind of the stereotype that most of the world has of the country now. They just play directly into that, like over and over and over again, proving that it's correct. I mean, I saw some libtard on Twitter saying, like, this kind of behavior is an embarrassment to the country. You're showing us up, like you're destroying our reputation around the world. And I thought, no, it's you. You people are destroying the country, the world, because nobody, when they're looking inside from outside, and all of these people from around the world are looking inside at Britain, they see a lunatic asylum which persecutes and hates its own core population. They don't see some kind of enlightened multicultural paradise. They say a nut house, an absolute madhouse that hates and despises its own people. But the libtard is like, oh, this makes us look bad. And I'm like, no, you make us look bad. It's embarrassing.
One thing that I was embarrassed, I found it embarrassing in the autumn, and I was in as I said last week, I was in Moldova, the poorest country in Europe, and the attitude of Moldovans was, God, thank God I'm not in Britain. It's full of crime. It's dangerous. The you know, they hate their own population. Everything's done for foreigners and Iraqis and black people and whatever. I'd rather be in Moldova, even though they have to grow food in their gardens in order to have enough food, which we stopped doing generations ago. So that,
well,
that's,
hey, but
that's
Ed, could I push back on that? Because we've been enriched, it's now possible to go to your local supermarket, fill up your carry-all with as much food as you want, and walk out again. And that's a positive cultural development that we never used to have.
No, but I assume it's possible for me to do that, for me to not pay. Is it possible for me to get away with that? But yeah,
I think it's possible for everyone now, because the police apparently don't ensure, you know, don't enforce shoplifting rules anymore.
I agree, Paul. I was somewhere recently, and a pastor told me that a lady went to the supermarket and she packed her trolley. Her trolley was packed with different goods, and she left the supermarket without paying. She's on welfare. And she said, okay, she does it all the time.
But is she Jamaican, so it's okay?
No, she's not Jamaican. She's a white lady.
Well, she should be birched. And I don't, you know, I've no problem saying that publicly. Surely.
No, but surely. I want to speak to Morgott, because I was not born in the UK. And I agree with him. People from outside the UK, both foreigners in the UK and people who live in other countries, they think the UK is akin to a lunatic asylum. Like, I've spoken to people outside the UK who are basically disgusted with the welfare system. They think that the Brits have become lazy. Too many people are on benefits.
Well, what are you doing in what are you doing in the UK, if you don't mind me asking, Lipton?
No, I came, what am I doing in the UK? I came here to study. So I came here in 2023 to study. And I was in Scotland. That's why I came here. And I came here because I'm fond of the UK. I like the British and I like Empire. So that's why I came here. I regret that the British lost this Empire.
Right, I see.
Okay, as long as you stay out of the northeast. But I'll keep that pristine. I want to keep Durham pristine. That's what I don't care about anywhere else. Durham, I care about. But yeah, it's ridiculous. And going back to the hypocrisy of it, both Paul and you, Morgott, watched this interview with Trevor Phillips. So can you tell us a bit about that, one of you? I don't know who I'll pick. Paul, can you start?
Yeah, well, it was just, I think it might have been one of the Sunday morning programs. I never remember which one Trevor Phillips is on, because I only ever watch the repeats on YouTube. But he had David Lammy in the chair, and I was saying to you off camera, Ed, he managed to make David Lammy look, even given his base level stupidity, Lammy, he made Lammy look even more ridiculous by getting up on screen a whole list of Labour MPs and senior MPs who'd referred to the George Floyd killing in the past, saying that they had great rage and that everyone should be filled with rage. But then as soon as Nigel Farage uses the phrase cold rage, that's somehow verboten. And he just says, you know, that this is rank hypocrisy, isn't it? And Lammy had nowhere to go, and more than usual even embarrassed himself.
Yes, presumably he thought that a brother would not treat him like that. You know, I assume he thinks that kind of way. You know, surely he's you're my brother, dude. I'm not your brother. I'm an interviewer for the television, and I'm going to hold you to account as Lord Chancellor or whatever it is that he is. Yeah, what were your thoughts on that, Morgott? You watched it as well.
To be honest, even before we get to what the actual sort of conversation was about, we've basically got a setup where two black men are sitting discussing whether or not the whites are like victims in their own country. That, like, just from the off, because you become kind of used to these things. You know, instead now people will move directly to like what the actual subject matter was. But really, like, You've got two black men sitting on primetime television, one of them and one of the most powerful people in the country, if you actually believe he has any power. And the other one is a senior, he's been kicking it around a long time. And then they are going to have a casual discussion about whether or not there's like two-tier policing, whether or not when a white is murdered, that there should be like as much respect paid to him as what there will to a black man. And I just take offense at the entire thing of it. And I realize there's not much I can do about it, yeah?
No, could I ask, well, what would you prefer? Kathy Newman interviewing Lammy or Trevor Phillips, who's actually a bloody good journalist?
Yeah, well, it doesn't matter. Trevor Phillips may have well asked the better questions, but at the end of the day, I'm then in the position of thanking a black man for not hating me. I'd rather just have actual representation. And this actually leads on to a bit of a problem, which what people have been mentioning a lot, which is something that Bowden picked up on, where the actual native population are now just like going to have to hold up their hand and beg for their piece of the civil pie, just along with any other minority. And a lot of people are have an issue with this. This entire discourse is kind of toxic, because then we become just another kind of data point and a demographic amongst like 100 others.
Doesn't that galvanize us? Because that make us realize that there's something to fight for. We have to basically reach it, to use an Alcoholics Anonymous, cliche. Yeah. We have to hit rock bottom before we realize, hang on, we've got to fight. Like the Kazakhs, and 70% of people that live in Kazakhstan are Kazakh at the moment. If you go back about 50 years, it was 30%.
Yeah. So
they were a minority of 30% in their own country.
Right, but I just don't understand the logic, though, of given where we are, in the situation we are, surely it's better that what we should be trying to get is the best possible positively antagonistic journalists to hold hypocritical politicians to account. You could fill the airwaves with 100% white people like Kathy Newman, Emily Maitlis, and a whole tranche of idiots like Piers Morgan. And how, in practical terms, would that be any better for the white population? It would be worse.
It wouldn't, that's not what I'm talking about.
The symbolism versus the actual effect. So you'd prefer an all-white... Let's just hypothetically say every single TV presenter is white, but if they're actually suicidally empathetic vandals to British culture, how does that help anyone?
Yeah, it doesn't make any difference, does it?
Well, it makes things worse in a way, because Trevor Phillips, you might not like the fact he's black, but he's a bloody good journalist, and he made Lammy look like a fool. Emily Maitlis would have sucked up to him.
I mean, I'm just saying what I saw in that clip. I don't watch the mainstream media.
It's the pragmatism. I see both points as a Mr. Chairman here. It's the pragmatism which Paul is talking about versus the kind of just the sort of visceral.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the pragmatism of getting the message across. I'm just talking about the symbolism where you've got two black men talking about you as a third party.
No, I get that.
That in and of itself is the issue.
Well, symbolism is one issue. It's not just the issue. It's an issue, and it's an important issue. But the pragmatics of actual events in the world aren't nothing. They're something, and they're even more significant.
Yeah, that's why I have Lipton here.
Okay, no, Ed. I have an outsider's perspective because, one, I'm black and I was not born in the UK. But what I will say is that black publications, predominantly black countries and predominantly black publications, they are not interested in symbolism. Many of them are also rabidly anti-non-black. So their perspective is that only black people can articulate points in favor of other blacks. I don't share that view. But what our colleague here is saying is that black people really can't be the face of white lash. It's like conservative ink. Conservatives in America like to pander to black conservatives, like, let's say, Candace Owens was basically plateaued, or famous, not plateaued, but intellectually she has plateaued. So if you want a movement to be taken seriously, white people should have the confidence to say what black people do say and are not punished for. I think that's what some white activists are saying. So I'm agreeing with Paul, but I get what Morgoth is saying.
But they don't.
White journalists should be able to speak in such a manner. Controversial issues.
Should we call it the Sweller Braverman effect?
That we good.
We only allow it can only be done by a person who is non-white and that doesn't have this kind of hasn't imbibed this kind of guilt about being white. And if they haven't imbibed it and they're white, they're a thug, they're racist, you know, they're whatever. So for it to be civilized, it's like bizarre that there has to be a kind of brown, preferably female champion.
Yeah,
I have the right to speak in the same candid manner as a black person would or as an Indian person would.
So, Morgoth, what were you going to say?
Me or Morgoth?
Morgoth.
Oh. I was going to say you have to get your arguments through a proxy, through a politically correct proxy. And all that does is kind of recompound the original problem. But to get back to the point that I was making just before there, we're just this minority, and we are just like the Pakistanis or the Indians or the Jamaicans, and we now have to hold our hands up and say, well, we're against white lives matter. Why don't you take the knee for us? We are also now persecuted. And this is the thing that Jonathan Bowden warned about. And the reason why I bring it up is because more and more people have an issue with this in our circles, let's say. But the problem is, I don't see a way out of it. This here is where I agree with Peter. I just don't see how you can't have some kind of esoteric principle which is going to get you out of these hard material constraints that you are actually a victim of the state, and increasingly so through demographics. There isn't a way that you can kind of base thinking yourself out of that sort of garrote. So I'll take on board the point where we can't just become another minority with our hand in the air. It really does great. But at the same time, I don't really see a way out of it. Because even if you want to vote for a political party like Restore or Reform or whatever, even that party has to abide by the Equalities Act and anti-discrimination stuff and all of this kind of stuff. So you're stuck. And there's not really a kind of clever philosophical frame that you can use to get yourself out of that.
Well, presumably, if you're in a situation where there's no way within the rules of getting yourself out of it, the solution is some kind of radical, it was like a revolution, essentially.
I don't think we're stuck. I think Ed should relocate to the UK and form a political party.
Well, I'm not going to do that. I've lived
here. Why are you not going to do it?
Because I've lived here for 21 years. Ya nuton kessa. Ya kessa so meson tosi 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 hieno. Kaya kaunis. And I just know I'm here. I'm in Finland, and that's where I live.
Who was we in that sentence?
Well, me and my wife.
I mean Lipton. When Lipton said we are not stuck, who was we?
Lipton has been made an honorary Aryan by me.
Right.
It's just a weird thing that's happened. I don't know how it occurred. I think Morgoth, he means
Morgoth. Is it okay that Ed lives in Finland, but it's not okay that Lipton lives in the UK?
Oh look, I don't want to have to deal with all this. Is Peter just like a shit lib? I don't care that Ed lives in Finland.
I'm not allowed to discuss it.
I don't care that Ed lives in Finland. I do care that Lipton lives in this country.
Right, I'm trying to work out the reasoned argument for preferring one, if there is a reasoned argument, preferring one or not preferring the other. That's unreasonable to ask.
Because one's replacing me in this country and the other isn't.
I'm not replacing you.
Well, I think that's the argument, Lipton, that it's a difficult tension for me, because I take the view that in terms of immigration, I will. I basically think that immigration should be very, very, very small, very, very tiny, tiny numbers. But that if we have it, it should be people that are intelligent, intelligent, and intellectual. Because that's and he, I can see the argument for that kind of immigration, but it should be minute. But anyway, moving on. The next issue that has come up is that the I think we looked at it, is that the managing director of Iceland has actually noted. So it's not just Trump saying it and Vance saying it and Lammy having to ring him up, but explain it's not true. But it's the it's being noticed on the ground. There was a case in the supermarket Iceland of an Asian chap who tried to stop a black fellow from stealing. And the black fellow said, "You're racist," and the police were. He rang the police, and the police came. And the guy noticed if you ring the police and say someone has stolen stuff, then they don't come. So this is an obvious example. And the police in Hampshire were very clear on this. We feel that we're allowed to talk. You know, we're indoctrinated. We have to think about race all the time. So that seems to me to be very, very clear and direct. And so I don't understand how long a regime can go on lying before it bends. I mean, it reminds me, I know it's a cliche, but it reminds me of Theodore Dalrymple's studies of towards the end of communism, where everyone knows they're lying. And they know that everyone knows they're lying, and yet they still lie. Do you think we're at that stage, Morgoth? Do you think it might flip?
Yeah, I think so. I think I did an article some years ago where I was comparing the Chernobyl in the Soviet Union, and I was saying like the sort of our grooming gangs scandal is a bit like our Chernobyl because it implicates the entire system in the corruption and the ideology is bankrupt, the politicians are bent, they covered it up, it was lies, and you can see it. And I think, I mean, I've thought for many years, way back since about 2014, that there was something about the grooming gang stuff that it was kind of like a poison dart on the regime, on the multicultural project. And that it was, you know, where when you get them poison darts and then it takes the poison spreads slowly through the system and then your organs just gradually shut down. And I feel like the way the grooming gang's issue is that for our regime, our multicultural regime, it's a kind of slow death. But what you land up with is the fact that it just comes down to power. Nobody believes in the political formula anymore. Some will, very few, or maybe so. But on the right, at least, nobody believes in the core principles. Nobody believes the politicians have got their interests at heart. Nobody looks ahead at a kind of big, bright future. So, yeah, it is like this Soviet system that nobody, everybody just wanders around thinking, how does this end? Is it going to end? This misery.
Well, the problem is that we're so rich. So the thing with the Soviet Union is it was even poorer than the poorest of these Eastern European countries, like Transnistria or whatever, is now. If you go there now, it's old ladies selling stuff from their gardens in the street just to get by. It's cracks everywhere in the pavements and the roads. It's nothing. Things not working properly. It's power cuts. It's all this kind of stuff is going on in these kinds of countries. And the Soviet Union was worse than that. But we are, even though food prices have probably gone up by about 50% over the last couple of years, even in spite of that, we're so rich. That's the problem. So people have got things. People have got things like houses and they own things and whatever. There's a lot to lose if society collapses. Whereas with the Soviet Union, nobody really had anything to lose apart from the absolute cream of the elite. That's the difference, I think, more. What do you think that's...
Well, another issue is that people are finding it more and more difficult to get away from the diversity. So, you know, it's one thing to say, to have like a kind of abstract principle, I don't care if I would be the only white person, but then to actually come to the realization that I am the only white person. And this is why I think you see a party like Reform surging in the polls. Because especially after the Boris wave, it's sort of a sense that you just can't get away from it anymore. And at the same time, as we saw with the Henry Nowak case, when you inevitably run up against the diversity, if something unpleasant happens, the state will take their side and not yours. And so I don't think, I don't think it's just a matter of being rich, because it gets to the point where people are just going to be scared to go down the streets. And people just feel constantly alienated. And whether you're, whether you've got money or not, you're just constantly watching what you say. Your wealth is at risk, because if you say something wrong at work, you can be fired. So it isn't just the minorities per se, but all of the traps and the minefields that have been set down to catch everybody. And I feel, and I just feel like there's more and more people finding it intolerable.
There was a Christian policeman. I don't know if you heard about this, Paul and Lipton. There was a Christian policeman. Yeah, did you hear about it? Christian policeman. And he was basically driven out of his job. He was essentially, he was sent on, there was on a diversity course, and he was told, ask anything you like. You know, say any questions, any concerns, now's the time to raise them. So he did. And the result of that was that he was called in by his governor and told, you know, I've got a problem with the things you've been saying, even though he was specifically, so it was like Chairman Mao, let 1,000 flowers bloom and then kill them. I mean, it was like that. What did you hear about Lipton?
No, yeah. Oh, yes. So I read the story online that he was fired. He was in police training and he raised some concerns and he was fired, and it was in relation to Islam and diversity. That's what I read. I don't find it strange, because as I have said before, Islam now occupies a sacred place in Britain for some strange reason. Whereas in the Arabic world, countries are either Arabic republics or Islamic republics, and they don't tolerate free speech. People of Islamic descent in the UK were still strong, were still practicing Islam, not those who have integrated. Many of them, they are not as tolerant as the average British person. But then again, how we define tolerance could be problematic for some people. If you're conservative, you might not care for gay marriage. If you're not, you might care. But the point is that they have not assimilated into the liberalism of the West. So I find it strange that there is such difference for Islam in this country.
Such difference. I mean, do you remember does anyone remember the Ray Honeyford case? Is it Honeyford? Was that his name, or Honeywall?
I recognize the name. I recognize the name, but I can't remember what the story was.
He was a headmaster in the 80s. And he said, okay, everyone has to learn to swim. And so we're all going to go swimming. And this Muslim father turned up at the school and said, like, what the hell are you doing to my daughter? Making her be semi-naked in front of other people. And there was this whole campaign by Muslims in the area, and he had to resign. This was in the early 80s, I think. And that's a total... The Hindus, they have no problem with that, but then they don't have this problem with nudity that the Muslims have. But it was a case in point that almost as soon as they got there, their attitudes were not going to integrate. And they were told they shouldn't integrate. That's the worst thing. They were told... This weird thing in Finland, this tension they have. On the one hand, they say, we are going to send you on an integration course where you learn Finnish and whatever. But on the other hand, oh, by all means, wear your Muslim clothes and wear your headscarf and all that kind of thing. It doesn't make any sense.
Ed, is it a racial issue or a religious issue?
It's a religious issue because the Hindus have no problem.
It's a religious issue.
Yeah, it's a religious issue.
Just to clarify, it's not necessarily just a race issue.
The other parallel is a story pertaining to dogs. British people love dogs. Muslims do not like dogs. In some communities in London, there are signs saying Muslims don't like dogs. But the Muslims are the immigrants.
Yes, I know. And some Muslim taxi drivers won't accept dogs, including guide dogs. So if you're blind and you need a taxi and you've got a guide dog, you won't be getting a taxi. And because they'll be overwhelmingly Muslim. And I don't understand how anyone can not like dogs anyway on a point of principle.
Well, I don't like dogs.
Well, you've got no business not liking dogs, Lipton, because they're lovely and they lick you and they're kind.
I just ignore them, though. When I am walking and I see dogs, I just ignore them. They don't bother me, I just ignore them.
Well, that's a bit rude to dogs, to be honest. But I do like dogs and cats. I don't like large spiders, I don't like. But then people that have pets like that are often high in dark triad traits. So, you know, I try to avoid them. Right. Good. So, yes. So we've done the COVID. Now, Morgoth, you have was talking about James. What's his name? James O'Brien.
Yeah, I did like a quick little article today about James O'Brien, and like, because I find that he's become somebody who's just truly despised, and like people just see like a 30-second clip of him, and they're just seething with hatred, which is perfectly justified. And I just wanted to, I think he's become this embodiment of like the repulsive lying shitlib, like this sophistry. And this kind of weaving of narratives and bullshit, instead of just taking what is real in the real world and being honest about it. I mentioned earlier that when what they did was kind of hang around after the Novak killing, and wait until after Nigel Farage made his speech, or you had protests in the streets. And then he even said on his show, well, I'm not going to talk about, I don't really have anything to say about the Henry Novak killing. I think I'll concentrate on Nigel Farage. And then he could call the rise of fascism and for how Farage was stoking up hatred. And the actual cause of it all just gets brushed away. That just sort of disappears in the ether so that he can just be this kind of vindictive piece of shit that he is. But I think in like the sort of the cultural discourse, He's become this like truly reviled and like repellent sort of lizard. Like he's just something truly grotesque. And I think it's because he's a kind of face of all of the resentment and all of the frustrations and injustices that the native people have to endure because of his ideals as well.
Why do we think, Paul, are you familiar with this O'Brien fellow?
Oh, he's horrible.
Why do you think he's horrible?
Well, apart from he's just rebarbative and I can't stand him, but apart from anything else, he was involved in that fake PDF scandal. It was a Carl Beecham, and as a journalist, he failed. He was swindled and believed everything he was told, didn't do due diligence, and was proved to be demonstrably stupid as a journalist. And yet, that never seemed to put him off his stride. Most people would think, oh, I fucked up, I'm a shit journalist, maybe try something else in life, but he never did. How can you be that heraldically wrong about something and then still have a primetime radio show and pretend you weren't wrong?
Is this the guest house thing? Is that what you're talking about? The Elm guest house or something?
I think so, yeah.
So this is this guy that I had on here on my channel about a year ago called Harvey Proctor.
That's right, that's the one, man.
Right, and he was that guy basically accused him of paedophilia and murder.
Yeah, and James O'Brien, that was a Freudian slip. James O'Brien gave him a voice and a microphone to make false accusations against people like Harvey Proctor.
Mm. And Harvey Proctor, when I interviewed him, I mean, it's years after it happened, but he was still so traumatized about it, and you could tell. And he said, I will think about that to the end of my days. I will never get over that.
Yeah, and that's one of the issues that I think we're not addressing are the structural things whereby people like James O'Brien can be so heraldically stupid and bad at the basic skills of journalism. But as Lipton and I say nearly every week, where are the consequences? No consequences. He shouldn't be in a mainstream job. Kathy Newman, after her interview with Jordan Peterson, should not work in journalism. The fact they just keep going is ridiculous.
I totally agree with Peter here. And especially because we've been told for the past week not to inflame tensions. We don't want to make this political and all the rest of it. And it's kind of taken as read that what they're talking about is people like Nigel Farage, Tommy Robinson, the right wing, the nationalists, Rupert Lowe, all of these figures, that's who they mean. But, you know, somebody like James O'Brien sends large swathes of the population into just a rage. And his reaction was like, the only reason people are getting so angry about it is because, this is what he said, the only reason people are getting so angry is that people don't, the police don't just automatically assume the brown people are guilty. And so they want. So what he's saying is, all of these people are racist, and they're frustrated that the police will actually listen to the brown people. And that's why everybody's so angry. And it's obvious, it's just such obvious nonsense. And it seems designed to drive people up the wall. And what's galling about it is that this is, we're being told, don't douse the flames in petrol, don't stir people up. But he's on LBC getting away with it. And we've got Ofcom to regulate this kind of thing. I mean, I don't like Ofcom, obviously. Nobody does in our circles. But if we have to have regulation of the media, why is he not being regulated? Why are none of these radio shows seem to get any kind of oversight at all? It's just regime propaganda.
It would go further than that. I mean, me and Paul have both worked in academia. In academia, if you publish absolute rubbish, then your contract probably isn't renewed and, you know, it's over. Or if you can't get anything published because it's rubbish, then there was a case in Aberdeen, I believe, in the Department of Gaelic about this, where someone put out this paper about how the monk that had written some bit of Welsh writing in the 5th century or whatever. I looked into it and I realised this person must be a woman. And the peer review was like, what the hell are you talking about? That's insane. And his contract wasn't renewed. And there's consequences for really bad research. You get a reputation as a person who has to have lots of their research discredited or whatever. There's consequences. That's really bad journalism. And he will have gone on, even when I did my most basic, you know, like work experience at my local paper. It's in 2001. It's drummed into you, you know, really seriously check your sources. Don't just take people at their word. You know, there's absolutely certain clear standards. And he failed in that regard, you know, clearly. And not just him, also Philip Schofield. And caused the most appalling damage. And we ended up with a situation where completely innocent people, in one case, died under suspicion of this stuff, in the case of Leon Britton. So he should have just been sacked, like, to stop the... Like, wasn't it a case, I believe I'm right in saying that with Boris Johnson, he went to Oxford, used his connections and whatever to get himself some plum job, and then he basically made up a quote. And so he was sent on, he had to go on a formal journalism course and work for a local newspaper for a while before he got back into international news. And it surely should be the same with O'Brien, I would have thought. But no.
As I said in the article, I mean, I think he's got a structural role. One, but I said, no matter the casualty rate, no matter the blood on the pavements and the gore on the streets that his worldview is responsible for, his structural role is to say to his own side, not one step back, and to his opponents, not one step forward. The enemy incarnate, distilled and concentrated like a greasy jam designed to make people vomit. And I think what he really is about is when there's something which tests the regime consensus. So in the example, which is in the news over the last week, it's anti-white policies in the police and the way that the police handled Henry Novak's death. And this places a stress on libtards. Like this means that they may not have a narrative frame to hand to kind of process this and deal with it. So if they go to work and somebody says, oh, well, did you see this or that? They need to have a way to kind of give an answer. And what James O'Brien does is provide that. So he goes out there and then he says it's this outlandish, crazy mumbo jumbo, which seems designed to get everybody riled up. But what it does do is to say, I'm not going to back down from this. I'm not going to take the L. I'm not going to admit that my way of looking at things, my ideology and my worldview is wrong. I'm going to double down on it. And even if I have to spin some fantastical yarn, which is just pure bollocks, then that's at least it's better than nothing. And then all of the libtards further down the food chain, they can go out and then they get to regurgitate what they've heard off him. And so it's a, he's a, like there, like a kind of watcher on the wall to make, to hold it, to hold the line, to make sure, sure that...
He's hardly narcissistic and he's invested so much of his sense of worth in that system of thinking. And so, of course, it, to back down. And that was an interesting thing I'd like to talk about, actually, after we have a little break in the middle, Morgoth, is someone like Trevor Phillips, who kind of has done that, which is an interesting thing about him. Okay, we're about halfway through. So to those who are new, hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We're our online public house. We meet on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, which discuss based science and interesting research and stuff in the news and stuff that's increasingly expunged from our woke joke universities. If you're new to the Jolly Heretic, would you please, please, please subscribe? You subscribe on here and leave a like and leave a comment for the algorithm and all that stuff. And also subscribe on my Substack, that's jollyheretic.com, where I put all the most based science I can put on YouTube, in-person interviews, vlogs, blogs, films I make. And if you like what I do, you can support me with the cost of a pint of beer a month. I will be in England later this month, and specifically on the 22nd of June, where there will be a sort of Jolly Heretic in-person meet and greet film showing sort of thing in London. So I don't know if I have any tickets left, but I might do. So just in case I do, and you, if you'd like a ticket, then look into that. It's on my website, jollyheretic.com. Next to me, we have Peter Murrell's hair tongs, otherwise known as Dr. Paul Taylor. And he has a very interesting channel, and that is called Readers of the Lost Art. What are you working on there at the moment, Paul?
Just done some on Moby Dick, a couple of videos, and I'm returning to do the whole of the Odyssey in various videos.
And at some point we're going to do Genesis, aren't we?
Yes.
Yes, but not yet. Okay, and so so please subscribe to Paul's channel, that is Readers of the Lost Art. Below we have Mr. Lipton Matthews, and his channel is Lipton Matthews. And you have a new book out, don't you, Lipton?
Yes, and you reviewed the book.
I did. Did you like my review?
It was okay. I expected a longer review. I wanted you to talk about Land Pritchett.
No, I tend to restrict my reviews to about 1,000 words, and I think you go. Otherwise, people can't be bothered, Lipton. They can't be bothered to sort of mess around. The book, the review should be a lot shorter than the book, I think, is a general rule. Okay, so a tepid response there to my loving and dosing review.
It was okay, though. People liked it. The people who read it, they liked it.
Busting African Delusions. So Busting African Delusions, chaps, you should go and buy that. And then we have Morgoth. Morgoth is on Twitter. It's a Morgoth Review. And he has a Substack as well, which is Morgoth Review, I believe. Do you have anything else, Morgoth?
Yeah, I'm on YouTube as well. And as I was saying before, I got a new little article up today on James O'Brien.
So go over there and subscribe to that. Okay, we don't seem to have any super chats, so I'll move on to the next issue. So I was interested before the show, we kind of broached this, which is, I find it very interesting. Trevor Phillips was the head of the Commission for Racial Equality. And in light of what we've been saying about how if you give people, well, basically this involves giving people privileges. Oh, poem! God, I'm terribly sorry. We have a resident poet here at the Jolly Heretic Public House, Mr. Quinn, and he has sent the following poem for your delectation and delight. For Henry, it seems some are kneeling. This might very well be revealing. The left no doubt fear the end of two-tier, but sadly they never stop squealing. Thank you very much, Mr. Quinn. And if you like Mr. Quinn's poetry, which you should, then you can subscribe. The link is in the description to his channel. And you can purchase his book of Jolly Heretic poetry on the old Amazon. But I want to go back to this Trevor Phillips fellow. So it seems to me that the fact that he confronted someone like David Lammy like that and a number of other things he said, he's almost like he's realised he's wrong. He's matured. He's become less angry. He's got less of that angry immigrant going on, and more of appreciating what, in some ways, he's been behind us losing. That's what I think. I'll start with Paul. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, and it's where I just completely disagree with Morgoth's point about the nativist angle, because I just keep returning to the idea that if you have people who are white yet suicidally empathetic with everything that's wrong with this country, if you have the James O'Briens of this world, you know, he couldn't be any whiter. Whilst race, of course, is an issue, it's not the be-all and end-all. And Trevor Phillips is takedown of Lammy, I just thought... some people in the chat don't seem to care. I think someone said journalistic standards are a liberal construction or something. And this is what I do find interesting. I think spiteful mutants on the far right, I've said this before, just mirror the worst spiteful mutants on the left. And they're ideologically absolutely fixed in their position. So when someone like Trevor Phillips comes along and just argues an absolutely brilliant case and says things to Lammy, whether we like it or not, this is the state of Britain today, whether we like it or not, as a black man, he could say things to Lammy that a white interviewer either wouldn't say or would feel that they couldn't say, and that's a whole story in itself. But given the situation we're in, I think Trevor Phillips, his interview with Lammy was brilliant and forensic. He was like Andrew Neil when Andrew Neil's completely on form. And that's what we need. That's why journalism is important, to hold these people to account.
Morgoth, what do you think?
Well, I've already said it, really. You got Lammy on the hook, and we can kind of outsource everything to, like, based black men to represent our views, and it's a wonderful thing. I don't know what to say. You got Lammy.
No,
good.
Well, can I ask a question, Morgoth? Because I don't think you're hearing what I'm trying to say. Maybe
I am hearing it. I am. I heard it the first round.
Right. So, we'll ask you a direct question. With the Cathy Newmans of this world, if you're writing articles about James O'Brien can completely agree about,
I would prefer to have what was he called again? Trevor Phillips doing the interview than Cathy Newman. There you go. Are you happy?
I don't know why it has to be so confrontational. This is what I mean about people on the right who criticize people on the left for being ideological and then won't engage in a good faith discussion, because any discussion that isn't towing the party line, there's this hysterical reaction. I don't get it.
It's not a hysterical.
You called me a libtard before, so that's not particularly non-hysterical, is it?
It is non-hysterical.
Well, calling someone a libtard who actually isn't left-wing and is on a program like this and has quite good discussions with Ed, it begs the question, what the definition of libtard seems to be as wide-reaching as a Portuguese trawlerman's net.
Right, okay.
I don't know about that, but I think that it's there's a sort of a nuance. I've told this story before. I was once in a pub in my personal view is that we should go back to the 1st of May 1997, and if you're in the country then you may stay, and if you're not, unless you're married to a British person or something, then frankly, you know, you can leave, you can go, unless there's a very, very good exception, such as that you're a major nuclear scientist that we need or something like that. I think that's a reasonable thing. 2nd of May 1997. But I if you put me in a situation, what would I rather be, on an island full of English woke people or an island full of English people with some immigrants and, you know, nobody's woke? I think I'd rather go for the latter. What do you think, Morgoth?
I would choose the white people.
Even if they were ghastly white people?
Well, I think there's a kind of stereotype. Like if I was to live, what is it, Cathy Newman's? Cathy Newman and James O'Brien, or like an island of diversity, I would choose Cathy Newman and James O'Brien, because I'm probably less likely to have my throat slit.
Paul, I want to respond to your speech, Paul.
Go on then.
For any movement to thrive, it will require intelligent and flexible people who can organize and tailor a message effectively to reach a wide audience. If a movement is racialist, not my business. I am not bothered by racialist movements. But for a movement to truly become successful, it has to be palatable. And an inflexible movement is not palatable. So I am saying this against the backdrop of a commentator. I've written several pieces for Countercurrents, and this man keeps complaining that I'm writing pieces for Countercurrents and I'm black. People like that, they help movements to collapse. They don't help them to grow. And that's why the dissident right, the far right, whatever you decide to call it, it is basically a meme. People can't take it seriously. That's all it is, a meme.
I think they can take it seriously, but I think that there has to be a balance, I think. That's what I always forget his name, Raymond Cattell. Raymond Cattell noted, if a society is too open, it balkanizes and it's screwed. If it's too closed, then it stagnates. And I would have thought, I mean, you can probably, if you read, what's the book called, Lipton? On Genetic Interests by Frank Salter. Then okay. You can, yeah, you know, On Genetic Interests, right?
Yes, yeah, probably, I know, Frank.
You can literally start calculating. You could probably quantify it. You could say, well, if how many Danish people come to England, that damages our genetic interests at the rate of how many children per person. But they can balance that out if they invent something useful or whatever. And with certain kinds of immigration, you can probably make that calculation. But with the immigration we have at the moment, there is no, it absolutely doesn't bring anything positive at all.
Yeah, and I agree. In Denmark, Sweden, Germany, England, and Finland, immigrants from the third world are drawing on resources. Secondly, high-skilled immigration is also a problem because intelligent immigrants are more adept at lobbying. And that's why they're a problem. So Koreans, for example, are not seen as hostile, but South Korea is a powerful lobbying force in the United States. And when I say powerful, I mean that they are hyper-powerful. Probably the South Koreans rank number four. They're fourth on the list of lobbying countries. They have many business organizations in finance. They have propaganda societies where people don't pay as much attention to the South Koreans as they do to the Indians and other groups. So smarter groups can even be a bigger problem than low IQ groups because they know how to lobby and shape policy. Whereas low IQ groups become a drain on the system, smarter groups can say, okay, we want to tailor immigration policy so more third world immigrants are imported into the UK, not just people from South Korea, but even people from Nigeria. And that's why high-skilled immigration could even be more dangerous than low-skilled immigration.
Yes, this is true. And in this country, in Finland, the high-skilled immigrants will tend not to learn Finnish. They have absolutely no need to learn Finnish. They never practice it. They don't need it. And in day-to-day life, I don't need it. And then Finns get used to it. So it literally happened yesterday that somebody said to me in Finnish, "You can't park there. If you park there, they might give you a fine." That's what she said. And I understood her perfectly. And I was like, rolled my eyes, oh, and turned around and went back to my car. And then she got out of the car and went into English automatically and then repeated herself. And so it's changing the very nature of Finland. You end up with just English conversation because there's an assumption. She realized I was English. I don't know, I look English or something. Or I didn't respond. I didn't say anything to her. I just rolled my eyes and turned around. And then you just automatically go into English. And this is a big thing. But you do. What do you think about that idea, Morgoth, that some skilled immigration, some very limited,
I'm not like a purist or anything like that. I understand that. I don't see a problem in that. I mean, the thing about the living with libtards as well, like the idea that living with the woke is going to be some kind of nightmare, it really isn't. A lot of these places I went to Brighton about 10 years ago, and it was irritating. You did see the messaging in the pubs and stuff like that. But you didn't feel in danger. You didn't feel like, I suppose, as long as you stayed away from politics, you could walk perfectly healthy along the beach. I went fishing. I went for a few pints. And they were all like completely, you know, it's like a hotbed of like progressive ideology. But it's livable in the same way that, you know, those leafy shires where the Lib Dems, they are kind of like little white ethnostates and perfectly livable. I don't. It's what the problem is, the outcome of the politics. But on an in an actual place to live, it's probably very pleasant. But the issue that you run into is what the larger outcomes for the country are because of their politics.
Yes. No, I agree. When I said I live with non-whites, I meant based intelligent non-whites. I can't emphasize that enough. There's a very specific subsection of them that I would be happy to live with. But yeah, in fact, that's one of the worst things about these places. Like when I was in Stamford, I did this film about Stamford, which is it was overwhelmingly white. I met one non-white person while I was there, and she was from Mauritius. He had all these people saying, "Oh well, I'd love to live in Leicester. I love the diversity. But it's just I like a slower pace of life." They'd use these euphemisms to cloak their own, you know, basically their own their own adaptive ethnocentrism. But oh yeah, I'd love to live there. It's just that there's crime there. And I like the pace of life here. I'd love Stamford to be diverse. I'd love it to be diverse, but it isn't. And it was so tiresome to try to, in the words of that Chinese fellow, to try to get them. This was middle class white people, I should emphasise. When I was in Market Harborough, there were working class, which is also around that area. There were working class white people, and they were just direct. Yeah, we live here. It's English. We're English. That was the thing, the middle class. That was the problem.
No, another thing is that, you know, when I was growing up in North Tyneside and stuff, the actual working class whites weren't always very particularly nice either. Like, it was quite violent. I mean, you know, Newcastle and North Shields was famous for people getting glassed for fights. And I think what's happened is just to sort of push back against the idea that we're these kind of ideological sort of spurgs, it is the case. I think people now have got these kind of rose-tinted, maybe they're a bit young, you know, maybe it's the Zoomers and they don't know. But I'll tell you, when I was about 14 or 15, we had riots in the Northeast that dragged on for weeks because it was all to do with joyriding. Basically they burned down North Shields, they burned down Meadowell, and it was all white working class. And they were what happened was that they were basically just stealing XR2s and boy racer cars and then screaming around the place and then burning them out. And so the police invested in like escort Cosworths and all these Reynolds things, and it was like a kind of arms race that was getting more and more sort of ridiculous. And the police got one, I think it was like an early Reynolds Laguna, and they had it rally prepared. And then those lads from North Shields broke into the police station and stole the actual police car. And then the police rammed them both off the road and killed them. Just next to where in North Shields, just next to where the swimming baths is, I think. And the point is, it wasn't all a pretty picture. There was like scumbags, and I find it interesting that now, like, the whites have become sort of passive. And in my life, it used to be so different. There used to be so much more energy and anger in kind of like youthful whites, which is just totally gone now, it seems to me.
Testosterone collapse.
I can't explain it, to be honest. It could
was
be that. That
was your part of Liverpool like this, Paul?
The Tocky riots.
Tock's death. Yeah, but that. But
yeah,
that
the Tocky riots. That was quite an event.
Right, yeah. But that was that not blacks?
Not all, but yes. Well, Toxteth was the one area at the time that had a historical Caribbean community, yeah, and that's when it all kicked off against the police. But I would have said disproportionately would have been black people, but that's also because demographically it was disproportionately black. I think quite a few other people joined in. It was just an excuse to have a go at the police.
Yeah, my friend, an old friend of mine commented, he's from a place called Worcester Park, and he said he would have felt a lot safer. Then he moved to somewhere like Bethnal Green. And I commented, is that not a bit dangerous, Bethnal Green? And he said, I'd feel a lot safer walking around in Bethnal Green at night than Worcester Park. And back 25 years ago, that was true. And you had gangs of quite unpleasant, yobby white people that would hang around outside the fish and chip shop in Worcester Park. It wasn't nice. It was rough. And we are in danger of idealizing that past. I don't know what's happened to those people. I imagine a lot of them have had babies with immigrants and are now seen as immigrants. That's what I would imagine. In fact, statistically, that's what's happened. And we are in danger of romanticizing that. Even my grandparents' generation would talk about, oh well, we're working class, but those people, they're rough. And there was a clear distinction between the two, and the people that were rough, they were rough, you know, the sort of the underclass. So yeah, that is certainly true. But then presumably, it's the same. You know, there was that after there was the Stockport massacre, there was Catholics and Protestants united, marching against this. And these are communities that would have despised each other as recently as 25 years ago, where if somebody that were Catholic girls were walking through a Protestant area of Belfast to go to school and they threw balloons of piss at them. And that's how much it's changed in the face of the outside force. So do you think that's an element to it, isn't it? There's an outside force, and that's why you forget about the internal divisions.
Yeah, possibly. One of the things that comes up is when Americans will say that the reaction of men, fathers in the grooming gangs, like, why did you let that happen? The first thing is, like, nobody actually knew what was going on. And it's only in the last few years. But still in that area, you think there would have been whites who did know it was happening. And I mean, I'll put it another way, because I remember when there was the, I was working in Holland at the time. And when the London, the 7/7 bombing went off, I actually expected that mosques across the country would get burned out. Because my understanding of like where I'd come from and how rough it was, I just kind of sort of extrapolated that to the mentality of the whole country. And I thought, well, that's it, that they're going to burn out every mosque in the country because of this. And nothing actually happened. There was like almost no backlash whatsoever. And I was like, well, okay, I suppose. And there was just this sense that throughout the 2000s, everybody just became more and more passive. I haven't really got an answer for it, to be honest.
We were. I mean, it's an interesting point. I don't know what people think, Lipton Paul. I don't know what you think about this. But in the 2000s, there was a sense of being richer than you used to be, I think. Even something as basic as there was that TV series, what was it called? Airline, set at Luton Airport. And you could buy flights abroad for next to nothing. And only, literally, you'd only pay the taxes and you could fly to Dublin for nothing. And there was this sense, I think, of positivity after the around that time, that things were going well. Things that used to be expensive were cheap. And now things that used to be cheap, like steak in a restaurant, are expensive. And so I wonder if that's relevant to the 2000s. Things were, for the whole of the 2000, that decade, 2000s, right at the end, things were going well and people were happy and they were positive. And now suddenly...
The diversity influx, which kind of began in earnest around that point, I mean, after the 90s, sort of the Blair years, there was an element where, well, the food's better now. You know, you can get more food. I remember a friend of mine saying that the Quayside in Newcastle, and he was going on about these gyros and shawarma, which we'd never heard of before. And he actually said it's so diverse now. And I thought, like, where did you get that language from? Where did you pick that up from? Like, what? Because I was out of the country for most of it. And so I came back and say once a year, and I'd see the differences. And it had become like, you know, there was more cheap beer from Europe and all of this kind of thing. And so, yeah, the luxury, it was there. There was more stuff coming in than what there used to be. That's true.
But Ed, wouldn't you say it's the complete emptying out of the actual economy? I think we've had this discussion before, but we've basically deindustrialized and it's become a huge big Ponzi scheme where you get cheap labor. So even the NHS, rather than train British doctors or whatever color skin, we chose to import a load of doctors from all around the world. And because we just wouldn't invest in proper training within this country. We've got rid of decent middle class or lower middle class or higher working class, whatever you want to see it, manufacturing jobs. So all you have are these cheap jobs. And the Boris wave was all about getting cheap immigrant labour, even getting cheap immigrant labour, like I say, into the NHS. And that's what's emptied out the country. So it's affected the standard of living, like you're saying. But it's also made people passive. And on the back of that, you've got the institutions like the universities who've adopted this technocratic approach to everything. They've deprofessionalized to the nth degree. So it's all about process. And that's what you're seeing recently in politics. All these politicians say is we're following due process. They're not making any ethical or political decisions. And there's this technocratic prison that we're living in. That ultimately, I think, is the cause of all this passivity.
Ed.
Sorry, yes.
Some Jamaicans who migrated, people from Jamaica were fond of countries like the US and the UK, they consider the late 1990s and the early 2000s to be the glory years for people who wanted to migrate. The 2000s, the 1990s, those were boom years for many countries. But as Paul's in England, for some strange reason, people don't emphasize this point enough. Apprenticeship. The quality of the apprenticeship scheme in England has declined tremendously. And that was once a source of growth for the country. That's one of the reasons why England industrialized. And apprenticeships in England, they have declined. They have diminished in quality. And we don't discuss this issue enough.
No, that's true. And one of the things, one of the reasons for that was there was this focus when we were all feeling good and happy in the early 2000s on higher education. And the whole idea was, oh, well, look, people that have degrees, which was about 20% of school leavers, they earn more. And so, you know, let's all get a degree. And then they've completely wrecked the degree because you don't earn more getting a degree because every 50% of school leavers have a degree. So it doesn't mean anything to have a degree. So it only means something to have a degree if you have a technical degree or a degree from somewhere very, very good. And so otherwise the degree is a complete waste of time. And then we're seeing the consequences of that in terms of people that then, when I left university, everybody just got a job easily. I had a friend that would regularly, if he got pissed off with the job, he'd resign his job and he'd get another one. It was early 2000s. There was jobs of plenty. And now you get these people, they even go to somewhere really good like Oxford or somewhere, they can't get a job.
Exactly. So, I've met people like that, finance degrees from Oxford, and they can't get a high-paying job.
No. So the whole thing is, with this word Ponzi scheme, it's ludicrous. But then the whole nature of money for a long time, since World War II, has been money as debt. So you go back to what Paul was saying. If you stop manufacturing, if you stop actually doing, like, ultimately, what life is about is getting food. Life is about obtaining food.
Eddie, you have to answer this question. You got £5 for it from Nationalist Politics. You have to answer it.
Well, I'd love to accept a limited number and be more flexible, but on
the YTF.
Hang on. Oh, my God. We've got four questions. Sorry, chaps. We've been sent four super chats. So I'm going to do them in order. So Stephen Campbell says £5. I'd love to accept a limited number and be more flexible, but on long enough timescale, the breed is necessarily diminished. Not necessarily, because, I mean, whoever thinks of the Huguenots as French, even who thinks of our friend Paul here as Irish? Not me. There was a small amount of Irish immigration and they basically integrated and just speak English in a funny accent. So you know, lucky, oh, you are a lucky kid. Dirty as a dustbin lid. Yes, Welsh. Silla was Welsh. So you know, it's a relatively small amount of immigration, I think you're okay. Anybody else want to comment on that?
No, I
referred to the Ponzi scheme element because it's just got absolutely out of control. And I think Lipton made the point before, there are very few civilizations throughout history that have been completely hermetically sealed off. But likewise, if you have completely porous borders, you're not going to last very long in any recognizable historical shape.
No, fair enough. Fair enough. Morgoth, where does the Geordie accent come from?
I think it's really, I don't know. I think it was Danish in origin, I've heard. There was a lot of Danish settlement up and around the northeast. But I actually don't know. That's what I thought it was. I mean, the thing is, I did like a DNA test a few years back, and I'm much more Welsh than what I thought, and Irish. And I thought, but especially Welsh, and I was like, I wonder what went on there. And it just so happened I was out for a walk, and I bumped into a local historian who was doing like a survey thing of a big hall next to Delville Hall. And anyway, I got talking to him, and he was saying that what happened in the, it was all to do with mining, and they'd bring up Welshmen to break strikes in the northeast, and they ended up just settling thousands and thousands of Welshmen in the northeast. So the northeast miners would go on strike, and then they'd just bring up the Welshmen to break it because they also knew how to mine, and they ended up settling in the northeast. And obviously mingling in. But then it's funny because there's actually similarities with the Geordie and the Welsh dialect. So that could be like a thing, but I haven't looked into it much.
Paul, you live in Wales. Do Welsh people use the word canny?
No.
Oh, okay, that's the only Geordie word I can remember. Okay, the next question comes from Goth Bureaucrat, and he says, Dutto, how do we watch this once the stream ends? Well, it's on YouTube. Paul or Lipton says something offensive, it will stay on YouTube. So you just watch it on YouTube or watch it on Twitter. It's that's how you do it. Okay, next question comes from Helga B3Y, and she says, she says, our struggle, capital F, is ethnic in nature, no compromise. Okay. Good. I like your no compromise attitude. I have no compromise with regard to change. I'm against all change. The next question comes from Nationalist Politics, $5. Thank you, sir. YTF, don't know what that means, we involving a black man in capital letters in a discussion about white replacement when he is the one doing the replacing? Because he's a lovely, handsome man. He's a based black man, and he has some intelligent ideas. That's the answer. Right, Nationalist Politics, $5, says, Morgoth is too good to be wasting time with this libtard and an African import. Well, first of all, Paul is not an African import. He's from Liverpool.
And Lipton's not a libtard.
I wouldn't call Lipton a libtard either. I think that's ridiculous. He's very conservative. He's even like a bit of a Christian. Like, I bought him a Guinness in a pub in Liverpool, and he wouldn't drink it because he's just so conservative. And so there was nothing I could do. I had to drink some of the Guinness myself. There you are.
I don't think Paul is a libtard, by the way. I think we just got off to a bad start there.
Thank you, Morgoth.
That's lovely. Are you? And if you could, it'd be lovely if you were in the same room. You could have a manly hug. Right. Someone else says Morgoth is too. No, hang on. There's a new question. I'm totally sorry. Bollocks. Go down. Right. Somebody. I can't read this. Why did you all lock the country down for the flu, but not this? Is this not as important? Or the World Cup? What do you mean? What do you mean? You mean Hemi Novak? Is that what you're talking about? I don't think the fact that somebody's been killed by needs to lock down the country. No, I don't understand the locking down. The locking down. I live in northern Finland. We didn't lock down.
But did you see, sorry to interrupt, but did you see one of Lammy's many stupid interviews? He said that basically everyone took the knee for George Floyd because it was during lockdown. So the implication was we all temporarily lost our minds, and that's why everyone started taking the knee after he'd been pointed out to him. I think it was Nick Ferrari on LBC. So he said, what you're saying is it was a purely symbolic thing, because he said the Novak family don't need mere symbolism at this point, when he was asked directly, would you take the knee for Henry Novak? So by his own, again, Lammy's so stupid, from his own mouth, he admitted that George Floyd taking the knee was purely symbolic.
Let's talk about that. It strikes me that one of the things that the Prime Minister said in Parliament was that it was outrageous that Nigel Farage should ask a question about two-tier policing, because the father of Henry Novak had specifically said that we would rather this wasn't politicised. But he didn't say that. What he said was, this is not about X, it's not about Y, it's about murder or something. That's what he said. He didn't.
But even if he had, Ed, even if he had said, please don't politicise this, with the deepest of respect to him and his family, it's not his place. It is political, irrespective of the family's wishes. Remember the guy who got stabbed with that narwhal tusk?
Yes, in America?
No, it was in Britain. He was working with ex-cons. He was a young lad, roughly around, you know, just left university. And his father...
In London.
Yeah, when he was killed, his father said, his death proves that the work he was doing was justified, when in fact his death proved the opposite. That his death proved his son was deludedly far too considerate of ex-cons, and you know, this belief that they'd suddenly change their spots. So the Novak family, you've made the distinction, he actually didn't say what he'd been reported to have said, but if he had said it, I don't think, terrible as it is to lose a family member, you don't get to control the whole political discussion of a whole nation.
I agree you're his father, and you have feelings about this, very strong feelings, and I'm very sorry for you, and it's awful what's happened. But we as British, surely, we as British, you know, we don't live in the Anglo-Saxon pre-Norman world where punishment relates to the family being able to track you down, beat you up. We live in a world that assumes that if you kill a member of the community, that is a problem for everybody else in the community, not just the family. That we don't live in a clannish world where it's only a problem for members of the clan. And it's a problem for everybody in the community if one person among us, of our community, is murdered. And we have the right to feel feelings about it. Lipson.
There is a pattern of the victims of white men. When they die, their families respond with elegance to the killing. They never call for violence, which is good. They're not violent people. But there's a stark contrast now. They respond versus how minority groups usually respond, even when the minorities were the perpetrators.
Yeah, well, the minorities...
Hypothetically, wouldn't it have been funny if Henry Novak's father had just turned around and said something like, I think on the back of this, you should all vote for reform, or something similar, absolutely, explicitly political.
Apparently, there's I think it was a sister or some relative has been like sharing speeches by people like Robert Jenrick calling out the double standards and the two-tier policing. And then you've also got Rihanna White's mother, who was murdered by an immigrant, and she's been kind of non-person. She's actually come out with the opinions that say, I want justice, I want these people to kicked out the country, I don't want any more, and you just never hear her. I saw her sort of running around in the replies of somebody like Suella Braverman or something on Twitter, or was it that Shabama Mahmood? Like, where's my hearing? So if you don't tour the party lane, you just get sort of disappeared. Because
I think that, Morgoth, I think that woman you've just mentioned, when she wrote directly to Donald Trump, I saw that news item. Yeah,
that happened as well. I mean, I do think it's interesting. I've been really critical of the Trump regime over the sort of the wars and in the Middle East and stuff. But I do actually like to see them putting pressure on the British government like that. And I know they've got all of their own issues as well. I think it's fair play. I think there's a temptation where everybody just wants to moan all of the time about everything. But I do like it. I do like it when somebody like J.D. Vance kind of shines a spotlight on the government and shows them up for what they are. I like to see them being made uncomfortable like that.
Well, wasn't that the complete hypocrisy? Our politicians telling Americans to butt out after having spent months on end interfering in the George Floyd case. The difference being, all of this recent activity is after the sentencing. Politicians in Western Europe were having a go about the George Floyd before the trial had even taken place. So they were prejudging the outcome.
Do you remember in 2004 when the Guardian encouraged readers of the Guardian to write, they gave them addresses to write to American people in like Ohio to ask them not to vote for George W. Bush and to vote instead for whatever his name was, John something or other.
John Kerry.
Who was the Democrat candidate for the ultimate interference in American politics. So I'm sorry, there's no... We have form when it comes to trying to interfere with American politics.
But you get the serious point, my important point about we were doing it before the trial of the policeman had actually taken place. And the recent, I don't think we've mentioned it, the Hampshire police, it was reported in the Times, trying to interfere with while the trial was still going on. They said they wanted to correct disinformation, which is against all British legal precedent and normal practice. They were going to interfere to cover their own arses because they looked terrible.
Did you see the fucking the guy that's in charge of Hampshire police, this bald ginger?
Yeah, why isn't he gone?
Good God, is there anybody in a position of authority in the UK these days that wasn't bullied at school for being an ugly bastard? I mean, I couldn't believe it and they put him on the front of the Telegraph and then website and they removed it because so many people were saying mean things about him. This guy with his candy floss tangerine pubes. I mean, it's insane that's the head of Hampshire Police. It's appalling.
That was an 80s rock band, by the way.
Well, that was just the police. But
candied tangerine ginger pubes.
Oh, was it? Okay, yeah, so must have been, they maybe didn't have a label. I've never heard of them. Anyway, we have another question, and this is from Max Settings 2906. Thank you, sir. Daniel Williams, a young white kid, was tortured, raped, and killed in Alabama prison 2 years ago. Southern United States prisons are homosexual torture camps for whites. Why is this allowed? You're asking the wrong people here. I've never been to Alabama and been to Tennessee, but I've been to South Carolina, I've been to Georgia. I've not been to Alabama. I can't really comment on it, but. Does anyone have any comment on that? Lipton?
No, I don't. I'm not familiar with that story.
I'm not familiar with that case.
Me neither. I've never been to America, but I can imagine it being undescribably bleak if you're in those positions, in those prisons.
Remember that sheriff who left, was it Texas or thereabouts, and he had an open-air prison because they'd run out of room, and it was like 110, 120 in the shade. And he had he just put them out there under tarpaulins, and he got into a load of trouble. He was supposed to be the harshest sheriff in America, he boasted about being. But that is acts as a disincentive, I would have thought.
Well, yeah, they give them, like if you've seen Shawshank Redemption, which is set in Maine, which is the whitest state in America, but it has Morgan Freeman in it, and they give them like armed robbery, 50 years in prison. But you'd get a suspended sentence in Britain these days for that. It acts as a deterrent. Okay, I'm going to round up, chaps. So it was a pleasure to have Morgoth on. So remember to subscribe to Morgoth's Substack. and his Twitter, and all that, and his YouTube, and all that malarkey. And we will see you all next week, which is yes, and then the week after there's a by election, isn't there? There's a by election, I think, on the 19th of June, isn't there? There's a by election in Makerfield.
So that'll be Thursday normally, isn't it?
Thursday, yeah, yeah. I think I'm going to England on that day. All right, so we will see you next week, and tally ho, and goodbye.
Goodbye. Yeah.